This is the Future of HR Podcast, episode 124.
The reality is what we mean by this is a really profound shift that's happening in the workforce. So as we think about the war for talent that McKinsey coined a couple decades ago, it was really about how do you acquire a person to come into your organization and stay there for as long as possible. What Christy and I are talking about in this book is more of it moving from talent acquisition to talent access for skills. It's not just acquiring that person and expecting them to stay for the lifetime. It's understanding that the workforce is much more fluid today and that skills are rapidly evolving and changing. And oftentimes you have to think beyond the traditional full-time employee model and really start thinking through how do we give people more freedom and flexibility and how do I move from an acquisition to an access mindset?
I think that Kelly is exactly right. And I think that access to skills is put an onus on organizations to find ways to develop those skills. Mm-hmm. So it's not just we're going to go search the marketplace for the right skills. It's how do we make investment in the people that we have today to upskill them and in some ways reskill them for the changing dynamics of the workforce and work itself.
What does it mean to be an essential leader? What is a gray-collar job and why are they critical to our future economic growth? Hi, I'm your host, JP Elliott, and this is the Future of HR Podcast, the only podcast whose mission is to inspire the next generation of HR leaders. On each episode, I interview successful HR executives and thought leaders who are reimagining, rethinking, and leading our field into the future. During our candid conversations, you will learn about their career journeys, their lessons learned along the way, and their insights on how to take our field, and most importantly, your career to the next level. Hey everyone, I'm excited to announce an amazing resource for next-gen HR leaders that has been 2 years in the making. After conducting over 100 interviews over the last 2 years with the top minds in our field, I have put all the best advice into what I call the HR Leaders Blueprint, career acceleration strategies from 100+ industry thought leaders. The HR Leaders Blueprint is completely free and filled with more than 18 pages of real-world advice from over 100 HR thought leaders. This guide delivers exactly what you need to know about building influence, driving business results, and accelerating your career. And just like the Future of HR podcast, the HR Leaders Blueprint is filled with simple, actionable, and proven strategies to help take your career and impact to the next level. To download the HR Leaders Blueprint, go to futureofhr.com. That's futureofhr.com. And if you want to get a jump start on your 2025 career goals, then you do not want to miss out on the HR Leaders Blueprint. My guests this week are Kelly Monahan and Christy Smith. Kelly's the founder and managing director of Upwork's Research Institute, where her and her team's focus has been on revolutionizing work paradigms with in-depth analysis of emerging technologies, remote work strategies, and fostering inclusive cultures for freelancers. Previously, Kelly was a director at Meta, where she led their data analytics initiatives. Kelly's also a frequent keynote speaker, where she emphasizes the importance of human-centric organizational leadership and strategy. This is Kelly's second time in the podcast, and her first visit was on episode 91, Future of Work Key Trends. Definitely check it out. Joining Kelly is Christy Smith. Christy has over 35 years of experience advising the C-suite of Fortune 500 companies, and she's held global leadership positions at Deloitte, Apple, and Accenture. And she's a highly respected expert in leadership development, talent management, organizational design, workforce management, change management, and executive team performance. Kelly's also a sought-after speaker, and her work has been featured in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, Harvard Business Review, Fortune, Forbes, and CNN. Christy's passion in life is solving for the humanity in the workplace. In pursuit of this purpose, Christy is a senior partner at Modern Executive Solutions, a senior advisor at Major Futures, and the founder of the Humanity Studio, a research and advisory institute dedicated to improving the way we live by revolutionizing the way we work. Kelly and Christy are here today to talk about their terrific and innovative new book, Essential: How Distributed Teams, Generative AI, and Global Shifts Are Creating a New Human-Powered Leadership. It's out this week, so I highly recommend you pick it up. You will not be disappointed. I really enjoyed my conversation with Kelly and Christy, and I know you will too, as we discussed why designing unicorn jobs is hurting both candidates and organizations, and what to do instead, the rise of gray-collar jobs, why employee agency and autonomy are non-negotiable elements for building high-performance cultures, why leaders need to spend more time identifying the work that needs to be done by a human and what work should be done by AI, and why essential leaders of the future will focus on their teams, not themselves. I'd love to hear your thoughts on this episode, so drop me a line on LinkedIn or say hello. And now let's jump into my conversation with Kelly and Christy. Kelly, Christy, welcome to the Future of HR podcast. How are you both doing?
Great. It's great to be with you. It's great to see you, JP.
Yeah, it's great to have you back, Kelly, and this time with Christy and writing a book, The Essentials. We're going to be talking about leadership, the future of work. Really excited to have you both on the podcast again. And before we dive in, I wanted to hear a little more about what sparked your collaboration, because you're both a self-described baby boomer and millennial, and you're writing a book about leadership. So how did this collaboration come together, and what do you hope really people take away from the book?
So I've spent many more decades in the workforce than Kelly. And I think that what we've had the privilege of working together in a couple of different roles, both at Deloitte and Accenture, we have collaborated on a lot of research and on writing. And I think our perspectives have really added a richness to the work that we've done together. We both are looking at the workforce as having changed so dramatically and frankly have a point of view. We align quite a bit, but there are some real departures. And the dialogue between the two of us and the research around it and writing this book together really allowed, I think, for a full view of the issue of leadership.
And Christy, I would say from my perspective, JP, you know me, there's very few people that I would agree to co-author a book with, especially on the topic of leadership. Because as a millennial, Christy knows this, I've got angst sometimes towards the executive leadership level. When I met Christy now almost 10 years ago, completely different type of leader than anything I've seen in corporate America. And her ability to maintain a human first approach. It's funny, like when we first met at Deloitte, we were going through an election year. Here we are again, 8 years later, going through a similar environment. And just watching Christy navigate that and lead through that, one of the things that we were actually talking about this morning that I think Christy really amplifies is being able to meet in the middle. And I think there's very few executive leaders who are really able to listen to millennials, be able to make space for some of the angst that we might have and change that we want to see at the very top. And so that's why when Christy asked me to do this, I knew she was the right partner because of the insides match the outsides there. And so what we're saying in the book is something I've seen modeled. And I think that's very rare today.
Oh, that's terrific. And I love that you guys are coming together. And it's beyond generational. You are different life stages, right? And your careers, which is also really important to bring that perspective together around what you've seen and what you've experienced and how that can really play out in what we all hope is going to be a new, really new future of leadership over the next 10 to 20 years as we continue to reinvent work, especially in the age of AI. We just don't know where that's going to go. Kelly, in the book, you mentioned that we're no longer in a war for talent. I think you're going to be really hurting McKinsey's feelings about the book that. But now at the war for skills, break that down for us. What's fundamentally changed?
Yes. No, I knew when we said this, McKinsey and the consultants were going to be happy with this. But the reality is what we mean by this is a really profound shift that's happening in the workforce. So as we think about the war for talent that McKinsey coined a couple decades ago, it was really about how do you acquire a person to come into your organization and stay there for as long as possible. What Christy and I are talking about in this book is more of it moving from talent acquisition to talent access for skills. It's not just acquiring that person and expecting them to stay for the lifetime. It's understanding that the workforce is much more fluid today and that skills are rapidly evolving and changing. And oftentimes you have to think beyond the traditional full-time employee model and really start thinking through how do we give people more freedom and flexibility? And how do I move from an acquisition to an access mindset? Because skills are so scarce today, especially sure we're going to be talking about generative AI and machine learning and really this new era of work we're in. But what we also talk about in terms of skill scarcity is the very human skills that the workforce is in leadership is in desperate need of. And those are scarce. And so that's what we mean by instead of moving from this war for talent that's one person, one-to-one relationship with the organization, it's moving to a one-to-many and being able to access skills as you need them over time.
Christy, anything you want to add on that?
I think that Kelly is exactly right. And I think that access to skills is put an onus on organizations to find ways to develop those skills. Mm-hmm. So it's not just we're going to go search the marketplace for the right skills. It's how do we make investment in the people that we have today to upskill them and in some ways reskill them for the changing dynamics of the workforce and work itself.
Well, I love how you're reframing access to skills, because I think a lot of times we've talked about build, buy, borrow. We didn't do a very good job on the gig workers and bringing people in, and we use contract, but it's not really as much as you're talking about access to skills. And so I love where you guys are going with that. Mm-hmm. And Kelly, you've also talked about one challenge to refining and redefining and expanding the talent pool is really what you call the rise of the unicorn job. Explain to us more what that is and why that matters.
Yeah, this was research that Christy and I found from Gartner. What was so interesting is what Gartner found is like in 2017, the average job had about 12 skills listed for the job description. That has ballooned to almost 23 today. And the reality is like of those 23, the majority of them are brand new skills that we weren't even talking about in 2017. We're calling this the rise of the unicorn job. We're also seeing this because of the rise of efficiency and this move to drive efficiency. People are being asked to do more with less. And this has really created a problem for many leaders and workers today is it doesn't exist. You can't do all these things and do them all well. And we're spreading ourselves very thin. And what we've seen just from a proof point here on our Upwork platform is our highest performing freelancers are those who are very specialized. They're not necessarily kitchen sinking their approach to work. And I worry sometimes as we look within our organizations, we've created these jobs that, you know, again, are unicorn-like. They don't exist in one person and we're expecting too much out of one person. I don't know, Christy, do you agree with that? Like in your definitions,
yeah, I do.
Thinking about this? I completely agree with it. I think it's one of the greatest challenges for leaders today that has shifted is how do they identify the right set of skills and architect the right team to get the work done. That is, no one person's going to have all 23 skills, but how do I look at my team and with intention develop a team that gets most, if not all of those skills resident, moving toward their common goal and their common mission?
Yeah. And when you guys talk about this, and I have seen this rise of the unicorn job myself, when you see what we're asking for, and I'd love your perspective on this, is that who's to blame for this, right? Because when I think about this is really business leaders being lazy and not really understanding for each role, what are the most critical 3 to 5 major deliverables or capabilities or experiences, whatever vernacular you want, that this role needs to deliver. And of course, there's a lot of other stuff they will do in their job. We're not very clear on what people really have to do. And so you end up saying, I want you to do everything. And which is really frustrating for a team member as well coming in, because now you feel like the expectations are just too high. Do you see it differently? Is that kind of where the origin is, or what is the origin from your perspective of this?
Christy's reminds me of what we were talking about before. I'm going to blame the leaders, and then Christy's going to probably balance this out. JP, I agree. I think what I've seen and what I've witnessed, especially coming out since the pandemic, has been an inability to prioritize and make trade-off decisions within our organizations. And I don't know why this feels different the last couple of years than it was prior. You know, a lot of people blame remote work or some of these other things. Maybe that's contributing to it. But the reality is I'm struggling seeing leaders in my lived experience actually make these tough trade-off decisions and prioritize. And I think we've gotten so fast, the velocity of business and decision-making has gotten so fast that we expect that same speed. Like if one more person tells me we need to sprint towards this project, you know, or be agile. It's before it was like once or twice a year you would do that. Now it feels like we're expecting these sprints to happen all the time. We've kind of lost the meaning of really what's urgent today. But Christy, I don't know. Do you want to balance it out here?
There's part of me that agrees with you in terms of prioritization. I think absolutely we need to prioritize what skills, what the job needs to do and accomplish. Completely agree with that. But think about what a shift in mindset that is for a leader to now have to diagnose that, right? And have to look at those 23 skills that is brand new to them as well and try to figure out what are the right priorities for the right goals that we're expected to execute on. This is why we need new kind of leadership, because leaders are coming in and looking at this unicorn job and these 23 capabilities. They themselves, it's foreign to them. because yeah. they've had a set of capabilities and been technically brilliant, which has gotten them their leadership role. And now they're looking at all this other stuff and going, well, wait a second. I have no idea how to do that myself. We have to look at the platform in the organization that allows for the development of leaders and the development of teams that can have these critical capabilities around execution.
There's blame on both sides always, right? Everyone can do a better job here. But I think organizations have to continue to really work hard at this. And I think to the prioritization trade-off point that Kelly makes, it makes a lot of sense. Because I think what you start to have happen then is people are now applying for these different jobs, and it's got more people applying than ever before. It's getting harder to find jobs and really cut through the noise. Someone even has those skill sets because the job descriptions get so broad. And I think then once you get in, it becomes more complicated. So organizations have to do a better job of figuring out what skills matter for them and what capabilities, and helping leaders translate that in the future. And a lot of times we are so busy in the moment, in the now, we're not thinking about what we need the next 12 to 24 totally. Or 36 months. So it makes a lot of sense. Hey everyone, after a quick break, we'll be right back to our conversation with Kelly and Christy. Are you ready to take your career to the next level? If you are, then you need to download the HR Leaders Blueprint, featuring battle-tested strategies from over 100 HR thought leaders and CHROs. This comprehensive 18-page guide delivers actionable steps, strategic frameworks, and real-world insights to elevate your impact. No theoretical fluff, just proven tactics to becoming a business-focused HR leader. And the best part, it's completely free. To download the HR Leaders Blueprint, go to futureofhr.com. That's futureofhr.com. And if you want to get a jumpstart on your 2025 career goals, then you do not want to miss out on the HR Leaders Blueprint. Now, Christy, you also talk about in the book, which I thought was really interesting. You push back against this traditional white collar versus blue collar framework that, and we love to do this versus that, right? This
totally.
And is very difficult for people. But how should we be thinking about skills differently in today's economy? It's not really white collar, blue collar. What is it?
Yeah, we talk about in the research that we've done around this is certainly there are white collar jobs and there are blue collar jobs, but there's a new category of jobs that we call gray collar jobs, which is really the combination of white collar, blue collar coming together. It's that knowledge that employee needs to bridge both sides of that equation, if you will. And we are, again, I think this goes back to the prior conversation, is how are we developing people in our economy? So blue collar workers who we have really categorized in one manual labor, mostly capability, how are we developing them with the tools, the software they now need to use, the machinery they need to use, the automation they need to use? And conversely, with blue collar workers and especially boomers. So Kelly, I can't wait for the millennial.
Exactly.
But boomers who are saying, I'm an old dog that doesn't want to learn new tricks. I'm waiting for retirement, right? I'm going to keep doing what I'm doing, right? So how do we get them to understand and move to the middle? So I think this rise of the gray worker, gray collar worker, is so critically important to our economic viability in this country and worldwide. And we are not spending enough time focusing on it.
Yeah, Christy, I think that's right. And actually, I agree with you. I mean, I think, JP, the other thing that we talk about in the book is, you know, when we look at just blue collar and white collar, it looks like we have very imbalanced markets right now. We have a lot of people who want white collar jobs, and we have a lot of demand in blue collar work with not enough supply. But as Christy just described, that gray collar framework shows that it's in the middle. Like, jobs are becoming half physical, half digital everywhere. I was just at a mining conference, and their number one thing that keeps me up at night is actually having that data analytics and software engineer in place, ready to go and work remotely now through drones and everything else. If we opened up our vernacular and our understanding of the labor market and made more room, as opposed to just having this dichotomy, we might not see as much of an imbalance either that's really there. And if leaders can see this, they might be spending much more time focusing, as Christy said in the very beginning, developing talent they already have in-house to move in this direction, as opposed to then creating another unicorn job, when in reality it's more of that gray collar worker that we're looking for.
Yeah, I don't think it's just organizations, right, Kelly? I mean, I think this impacts educational institutions.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
How are we developing these skills and capability? And you talked about access early. How are we creating access to this education for both sides? Fundamentally has the power, if we shift and really focus on a gray collar worker and that segment, it has the power to fundamentally shift the way we educate people in this country.
Totally.
And globally.
This concept of this gray collar worker is really powerful when you think about the physical and digital. There's really not an industry now that doesn't have a technology component. Even my sprinkler system at home, we have a setup that has a smart system that knows when it's going to rain, and I can use my phone to turn on that, you know, turn it off. Now, that may not be super high tech, but my gardener had to know how to set that up. I didn't set it up. Just in that example, we're not investing enough in trade. We're not investing enough in education that is more specific, going back to your point of the highest performing contractors, or if you will, or gig workers on Upwork are more specialized. Like, we don't have enough of that. We're trying to have generalists. And I think that feels like a mistake.
Well, and think about the auto industry. You really see some of the traditional automakers really struggling to get to electrification. Now the war for skills in terms of, can they compete with technology companies and getting the right computer scientists and data scientists and all of that, and how those two populations are coming together within the automakers themselves. This is causing a complete ripple in these organizations, and you're really seeing a slower start for the traditional automakers versus the innovative automakers who are starting from scratch with just an electric car. So that's just the impact to that industry in and of itself really speaks to this gray collar worker and the impact it could have.
Maybe pull that thread a little bit more, Christy. So what are some strategies that you think organizations should be trying to do to make this come to life, to build their gray collar workforce?
First and foremost, identify those jobs and those skills that you need within the organization, given the changing dynamics or markets or products that they are moving into. One is, you've really got to define that. The second is, I think you've got to have a pathway to develop your people. We are literally from morning to night, back to back to back to team meetings, Zoom meetings, whatever platform you're using. There is absolutely no time to breathe, to learn, and invest in the upskilling and reskilling. That is a side of desk issue that needs to move to front of desk in most organizations. Mm-hmm. Third is, I think you need new kind of leaders who are jumping in to understand these dynamics. To our point earlier, how do you build teams and pathways for development across, whether that's on the job training or using metaverse kind of capabilities to train people? Whatever that is, leaders need to now move into that architect and teacher as much as they do the fiduciary of the business. So, Kelly, I'm curious as to your thoughts.
I think that's spot on. And the only other thing I would add is, as leaders, oftentimes, as we think about where some of the learning and the innovation, where the gray collar worker might be, it's often in your operations or frontline. And this is where, especially where I know we're going to talk a little bit about AI today, this is where that can accelerate that learning and coaching journey. And I think reframing a lot of these like back office roles that were just wired for efficiency and operations, to now become your R&D. I mean, that is really the people who are your R&D right now, especially those closest to the customer. And I just think we have an untapped opportunity. Just again, just by the way we've designed org charts and the way that we think through front office, middle office, back office, I think there's a lot of untapped gray collar work going on in the back office. And I think that's where a lot of R&D is going to come from in the future.
Right. So that's interesting. Let's talk a little more about AI. And Kelly, you talked about how AI actually might make work more human, not less, which we all hope, I believe, but I think some fear it won't. But tell us more about what needs to happen to make work more human with AI.
Yes, to make work more human, we actually have to ask ourselves a fundamental philosophical question, which is, what work should be human to begin with? And I think we've talked about that in HR circles a bit. We've said, oh, creativity and innovation. But the reality is the majority of workers today are still doing a lot of work that we know can be offloaded to machine learning algorithms, soon to be AI agents, as they come into play. And so the question is, if a lot of the business administration that's being done within organizations can be done by AI, should it? I think is the number one question we have to be asking ourselves. And if the answer is yes, then what is the work that needs to be done by humans within the organization? Because in all of our research, we're seeing rarely is a one-to-one substitute effect likely, where AI, and even an AI agent, team of agents can come in and really substitute someone's job. There's too much else going on in the way that our economy works and the way that we're driving business value, that we still need that human connection. So to Christy's point earlier, we need to make more time for learning. I think a lot of businesses right now are cutting their way to growth as opposed to truly innovating and doing something new. And I think, again, with AI, AI can do that efficiency, cut the way to growth play, and your humans are going to be the ones that actually find, where's the new customer? Lord knows there are so many problems that businesses can be focused on solving for today, whether that's inequality, climate change, hunger, list the variables here. And the reality is we're not spending enough time of our human energy and competency focused on actually tackling what brings value back to society and customers. Because to me, at the heart of business is about how do we bring value back to customers and the societies in which we operate. And I think we've lost our way a bit on that journey. And yes, shareholder maximization is important, and that's certainly part of the equation, but it's a part of it. It's not the final equation. And I think we've done a full stop there at the expense of further human development and even the impact that we have in our societies.
Listen, I think AI has unbelievable potential, but you can't cut human intelligence out of this equation. Yep. The human intelligence in combination with technological intelligence or AI intelligence means that we have to develop skills in individuals around insatiable curiosity. Is the output that I'm getting real? What is the context in terms of the AI that does it understand the context in which I'm working and the individuals in which I'm working with? Discernment. How do I discern whether or not, given all of the factors that maybe AI hasn't taken into account, meaning customers, supply chains, looking at regulatory issues, right? How do I discern what are the right levers to pull in order to make the best expedited risk-free decision for the company? It is the absolute combination of that AI intelligence and human intelligence, I think, that gets us to the right answer. Right now, we're looking at shortcuts. I'm going to put something in there into the AI tool. It's going to give me an outcome, and boy, okay, let's go. We've seen unbelievable issues associated with that in the law and in manufacturing where that just doesn't work. But that does require a different skill set.
Well, and Christy, and I'll be curious, JP, to your opinion on this. What I get, you're spot on there with the human intelligence. And what I get nervous about is, in especially in HR and the way that we think about talent, we often haven't wired the job and the organization for human intelligence, right? Yes, I mean, yes. In many ways, it's like towards conformity and efficiency and the antithesis to what we need today. So I think that's like the real optimistic versus pessimistic. I don't think AI should and could be taking away all of these jobs, but I worry if we don't develop human intelligence fast enough within our organizations, that indeed might be a byproduct because of that.
Yeah, I think these are really big fundamental issues that we have to address and think about. And I think you're both really good points made. It's interesting because we have really designed organizations for the lowest common denominator and efficiency. And some workers really appreciate that. But what I think AI, as it becomes more augmentation of what we do or automation, is going to shift dramatically how we add value. And the reckoning, I think, for HR leaders, business leaders, frankly, all of us, got a 14-year-old son, 11-year-old daughter, I think is like, what is value? How do you create value? How do you create something that's new, different, and actually compelling for a certain audience, right? Or subset. And I think that'll be where we go. And then I think, Christy, your point's really valid that these are prediction machines, right? They're taking large data sets and predicting what should come next based on mathematical computations that we can't do as humans. Got it. Great, but they don't understand your CEO's perspective, what's happening in the business, what happened last week, what happened at dinner last night, that's going to change how you should present to that executive, you know, in that meeting the next day. And so that hopefully never goes away. Otherwise, we've hit singularity and we're now a sci-fi movie. But I think that's a really a key piece. How do you build that into work? Now, we're not going to solve that here, obviously, and there's other smart people, but hopefully we'll get there at some point. I do want to now, Christy, want to talk to you about a concept that is actually really related, is the concept of agency.
Yeah.
And as workers, we're seeking more control in like where we work, when, how we work, what we're even doing on the job, right? We all want autonomy and mastery. But many companies have not, while they've embraced hybrid work, a lot of them are forcing people back to the office. So what's your take on return to office push and hybrid remote work in the future? Where do you see that going?
I'm really discouraged, frankly, by these large mandates that we've been seeing come out of companies today with this blast of return to office. Here's why I'm discouraged about it. One is, it doesn't at least appear to me that the work has been done to understand what kind of work needs to actually be done in person. How are we structuring work? Where are we actually losing productivity or capability in the current circumstance of hybrid or what have you? What's the societal impact of a return to office on women and marginalized communities? How are we going to care for childcare or elder care or those needs that parents or family members may have? We're not asking those questions. So the SWOC of everybody returns to office is a very privileged decision, it appears this way, of who's in power. What I know is, and what our research certainly shows, is that the return to office mandates don't work. Companies are losing their premier talent. There is the world's largest retailer who had a mandate couple of years ago, everybody returned to office. They lost 80% of their number one and number two performers, the number one and number two being the highest performers. That is astonishing. And we are hearing noise about those high performers leaving. Now, RTO has also been a strategy to thin out the workforce. And we're not being honest about that. But you're saying out, you're losing the ones that you actually want to keep. My point is that a return to office mandate may very well be needed by a company. But where, when, for what reason? Let's be transparent. How does this impact your work? How does this impact your life? And let's have those conversations. And how do we make it work? What we know employees are saying is they actually want that agency to define who, how, and where they work. Where companies, I think, are lacking imagination is something we've been talking about for the last 10 years, which is how do you design work so that that can happen? And we still haven't redesigned work in our workplaces.
Yeah, well said. I think this is something we'll be talking about, unfortunately, for quite a while. I kind of said it's the new performance management for HR to kind of talk about, because there is some research, but it is a personal decision typically by that CEO or that executive team that's really driving this a lot of times. But then there's some organizations that are doing this really well, and they've really embraced flexibility and hybrid work, and they've really thought about what work should be done where, and does that really matter? So I think organizations are doing themselves a disservice to lose talent that isn't in their home market, especially for certain roles that can make do things anywhere. I think AI will continue to drive that. I think we'll see, you know, small startups that have very small teams using AI and start to accomplish big things by using remote work and being more thoughtful about that. But the jury's out in terms of where we end up with this return to office and hybrid work. So we'll have to come back to that one. Christy, you've also talked about a new approach to leadership, and you've mentioned something around this a couple of times, but you called this the essential leader flywheel model.
Yep.
Tell us more about the model and how we apply it.
When we were doing this work and really wanted to make sure that this book wasn't theoretical, but practical, and could be actioned on, we really wanted to come up with a model of leadership that we think meets the demands of a distributed workforce, of new technologies coming in, and certainly the global socioeconomic and political shifts that are happening in the world. We anchored on this notion of the emotionally mature leader. We've had in our history and models of servant leadership and emotional intelligence And I think those are critical and they're great precursors to what we're calling emotionally intelligent leader. And that is a leader that who first has to have a mindset shift. And that the mindset shift, which is the first piece of the flywheel, is that mindset shift is, it's not about you. It's this suspension of self-interest. How do I, while emotional intelligence is about how I understand myself, emotional mature leaders is how I best understand my workforce and the people within it. And then you've got to look at and pivot to how do you create a knowledge base, if you will, of your people so that you can design their work and their jobs to maximize not only productivity and efficiencies, but maximize their experience in the organization. And that only comes from insatiable curiosity about who is working with you. This is a skill that we've been afraid to use within our organizations. I've worked with many leaders who, especially when they're talking about somebody on their team who's different from them, simply are afraid to ask a question. Well, they're Black, I'm white. I can't, what am I supposed to say? I'm like, they're a person. They're a man or a woman. What am I supposed to say? There's fear in engaging on a human level and being really curious about those. So the second is really developing that skill set and having contextual competence of understanding where your employees are coming from and what they're bringing to work. And then building a culture in which they can thrive. And it's a lot of what we've already talked about within this discussion of how do we become architects, educators, and managers of individuals who can thrive. And so this flywheel that you're speaking of is really how do we use the momentum of those things to create the essential leader.
The only other thing I would add, Christy, is as part of that mindset shift, and this is something that we've talked about in the book, is from an organizational level, so often, especially as HR leaders, we think about what is the talent I need for the organization? Or leaders start from that perspective of what do I need? But where the flywheel becomes very powerful at an organizational level is when you start to think about how do I design experiences to meet the needs of people? And that really starts the flips the paradigm upside down that allows that flywheel to get in motion. Because then you're going to be, as Christy said, you're going to have the space to suspend your self-interest. It's not about you. You're going to be curious about what are the type of experiences that I could help meet the needs of people. And I don't think we often start from that paradigm as HR, where we think through design and experience. So that's just the only thing I would add at the organizational level that I think is really profound.
Yeah, I think it's a great model, and this emotional leader concept makes a lot of sense. And I think it requires people to have other thinking, which is, I give that credit to Rhonda Morris, who's the CHRO at Chevron, brought that up, right? And it's a great concept. And I was like, oh, it just stuck with me, this other thinking, because I say that a lot, it's not about you. It really isn't. I know we all want it to be, but the more you make it about somebody else and your team or the customer, great things happen. It's hard to do, but to push your thinking about how are you impacting others, everything changes. And you also, as a leader, you stop almost worrying about being self-conscious. You're just like, hey, how am I going to help deliver for this team? Get the work done. So it's just a really good unlock. Now, not everyone's capable of doing it. We don't have this time in the podcast to go through why I think that is, but depending on how you're raised and upbringing, I think it's challenging for a lot of people to have this other thinking, but this is what we need. We need more leaders and promoting leaders to have other thinking, not me thinking. I agree. Mm-hmm. Kelly, we always want to leave on a very practical note for HR leaders. What's one thing they can start doing to really get their business leaders or organizations to start moving towards this new leadership model?
From an HR perspective, the reality is, as people, we have two natures and two sides. We have a self-interested side that's competitive and wants to win. And then we also have this otherness side, just as an equal balance in many of us. It's much more altruistic. That's looking to do good and collaborate and lift others up. I would say for HR, what are my hopes is with this book is you start to think through so much of what we know about business today is appealing to that self-interested side of what's in it for me. It's a scarcity mindset. There's only so many promotions I can go around and I'm going to compete with others to get ahead. And that's how we've designed performance management. That's how we think about benefits and rewards, and the whole employee journey is really along that pathway. What I hope what we're doing here is providing an alternative to say, you know, that same person is just as motivated to do behalf of your organization to think about others, to collaborate. What would performance management look like if we were to appeal to that side of humanity? What would our leadership development look like if we were going to make leaders really collaborative and collegial up top? What does that actually look like, and what's the development that's needed? I think HR can help drive that conversation, start doing some small pilots to test this out. I'm pretty confident in the research and the science too. It's not just a feel-good message for those that read the book. It's also just makes the best business sense as well if you're trying to drive innovation and the best outcomes. So that's my advice to HR, is really think through, how do you appeal to the other side of human nature, and how do you begin to redesign the experience, performance management, and leadership development to get to that outcome?
I love that. Last question for you both. What is one word or phrase that you believe will define the future of HR over the next 5 to 10 years?
Courage. It's so funny, Christy. I was going to say conviction.
Yep,
courage and conviction. Yeah.
Courage and conviction. Well, we I think that it. Makes more sense. Courage, conviction. I'm glad you didn't say AI, but honestly, thank you for writing the book. Thanks for being on the podcast. I hope that we really take this new leadership model and the future of work that you're outlining in the book to heart. Thanks for being on the podcast.
Thank you so much, JP.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Future of HR Podcast. Thanks again to Kelly and Christy for sharing their new book, Essential: How Distributed Teams, Generative AI, and Global Shifts Are Creating a New Human-Powered Leadership. And as always, you can go to futureofhr.com to view all of our past episodes and learn more about our mission to inspire the next generation of HR leaders. We'll be back next week with Suri Shalatsi. Suri and her co-author are leading gender experts and Harvard researchers, and their evidence-based book, Make Work Fair: Data-Driven Design for Real Results, they explore the concept of fairness in the workplace and offer novel solutions for professionals, HR leaders, and organizations. This will be a great conversation and one you do not want to miss. Thanks again for listening to the Future of HR and being part of our community.